1 Corinthians chapter 2, 1 through 5. Let me read it for us. And so it was with me. This is from the New International Version. Brothers and sisters, when I came to you, I did not come with eloquence or human wisdom, as I proclaimed to you the testimony about God. For I resolved to know nothing while I was with you, except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. I came to you in weakness, with great fear and trembling. My message and my preaching were not with wise and persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power, so that your faith might not rest on human wisdom, but on God's power. Okay. Well, have you ever heard of George Orwell? I'm sure you have. I brought a book of his with me actually this morning. It's 1984. It's a pretty famous book, and I don't know, some of y'all may even have to read it in school or something like that. Well, on the front here, it's got, these are a bunch of, this is the 60th anniversary edition. It's got a bunch of little eyes here. So it's like little eyeballs. And, you know, if you know anything about the book, Orwell was really concerned about government tyranny. He really believed this sort of elite government would, usurp power, have power, and through technology and all sorts of stuff would surveil the people and control them, deprive them of things. And so he's a pretty famous or infamous guy or whatever. Now, he wrote that book in 1949, and many believe it was prophetic. Many believe that this is coming true. This is what we see in our world today. And, you know, I'm not going to comment on all of that. It may be, it may not be. You definitely see things with, like, Ed Snowden and the NSA and all of that. It's, you know, people are sort of sounding the alarm, this day has come. But there's another man maybe you're familiar with named Aldous Huxley, who wrote another book called Brave New World in 1931. And there's a guy I referenced a couple of weeks ago, maybe it was last week, I can't remember, it all runs together now, Neil Postman, who was a University of New York professor and kind of like a social critic, very much like what Orwell and Huxley did, Postman did, but you know, years later. Well, Postman said it was a mistake to think that what Huxley and Orwell were communicating in their books, that they were saying the same message. He said, that's a mistake. A lot of people think that they were basically saying, had the same message. Postman says, no. Postman wants to say that Huxley, not Orwell, Huxley was closer to the mark. And I want to read you a quote. It has a lot to do with what we're talking about today. And it's very thought-provoking. I want to share it with you. So bear with me here for a moment as I read this quote out of Neil Postman's book in the foreword. Says, what Orwell feared were those who would ban books. Remember, I was talking about the government tyranny and all that. What Huxley feared was that there would be no reason to ban a book, for there would be no one who wanted to read one. Orwell feared those who would deprive us of information. Huxley feared those who would give us so much information, we would be reduced to passivity and egoism. Orwell feared that the truth would be concealed from us. Huxley feared that the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. Orwell feared we would become a captive culture. Huxley feared we would become a trivial culture, preoccupied with some equivalent of the feelies, the orgy-porgy, and the centrifugal bumblepuppy. Not sure what that means, but I think he's basically saying be consumed with stuff that is of absolutely very, very little importance. As Huxley remarked in Brave New World Revisited, this is still Postman here talking, the civil libertarians and the rationalists who are ever on the alert to oppose tyranny, folks that are out there saying, watch out for tyranny, watch out, watch out, fail to take into account man's almost infinite appetite for distractions. And in 1984, Huxley added, people are controlled by inflicting pain. In Brave New World, they are controlled by inflicting pleasure. In short, Orwell feared that what we hate will ruin us. Huxley feared that what we will love will ruin us. And Postman believes, again, as I said a minute ago, that Huxley was closer to the mark than Orwell was. And maybe we see some of both going on. I don't know. You could debate it. On and on and on. But I think he's on to something. This thing about pleasure, this thing about triviality, this thing about silliness. Recently, I want to kind of tie this into a problem that's going on here in Vermont, as many of y'all are aware. Maybe some of you who get the Herald, Randolph here, I want to pull it up. I don't. A friend of mine actually gave this to me. Right here on the cover, former addict struggles to get straight. It's about the drug problem in Randolph and in Vermont. It's really everywhere. And this young man who's being interviewed, I've had the privilege of sitting down with him over breakfast a couple of times, and he's been in here a few times, and he's a really neat guy. But he, he's exposing, the whole reason he did the interview, he said, was to sort of expose how serious the drug problem is, that it borders on an epidemic, and it's everywhere. And numerous people in here whose lives and families have been very much affected by this. Well, recent studies have revealed, maybe you're aware, that Vermont has the highest rate of illicit drug use in all of America. The highest. 15% of people that were surveyed, I don't know what the age categories or what were in this one study I looked at, have used some form of illegal drug in the last month. 15%. I mean, it's like astronomical. And everyone has a theory. Why is this? What's the problem? What's causing this? And one article I read says that this trend is a consequence of factors including weather, politics, and proximity to big cities. And it was one of Vermont departments of health, one of their people that worked there. And I don't know the lady that made this comment, but I feel like it's a really superficial answer. Maybe those things play a role, but it doesn't really get to the heart of the problem. Like why do these things cause these issues? What is the problem? And one of the problems, and I've talked to some of these people myself, like I said, the young man that was being interviewed in this article and others, is boredom. We're bored. People are bored with life. And we live in a nation where we are drowning. This is where I'm tying it back into Postman's quote, we're drowning in triviality. We are drowning in silliness. And everything is about entertainment, about pleasure. Nothing is serious. Or there's little pockets of seriousness here and there. But as a whole, our nation is awash with just silliness. Just turn on the TV. It's just jokes. It's silliness. Even the news. It's all about entertainment. It's about portraying things in an interesting way, getting you to buy a product or whatever, or watch the show. And after a while, you don't even really notice it anymore. It takes a radical change of scenery to sort of click it on. Oh, yeah, this is going on. And I had a friend who, I wanted to brought a handful of books this morning, but that was all right, kind of spice it up a little bit. I had a friend who went to Sudan for a while, and he took a bunch of pictures. If y'all know anything about Sudan, it's been a place where there's been genocide going on for years. And literally, I think it's close to, I don't know when this one article I was looking at, the numbers, 500,000 people have been slaughtered. And millions have been displaced. But the book's a really powerful book. It'll change your life. I encourage you to get it. You can get it on Amazon. But he went and he just took pictures of these people in Sudan. Children, moms, quoted some of them, like African proverbs and stuff. It's a powerful book. But the reason I bring it up is to say, I remember him telling me, sorry, I'm trying to fight back the emotions, I get emotional. I remember him telling me when he arrived back in the States that he sat in the airport after being over there and taking pictures of these kids and these moms, these people that have been displaced and all that. And you know what was on TV? Britney Spears and her, when she was having that mental breakdown a few years ago, and she shaved her head and all that was going on, and I'm not belittling at all what she was going through, I'm really not. But that's what our culture was consumed with, Britney Spears. And he says he remembered getting sick to his stomach because he came from Sudan where this is going on, and here we are consumed with Justin Bieber and Britney Spears and McDonald's, and those are the things that sort of consume our attention and our appetites. Drugs fill that massive hole of boredom for many, many people. And it's no coincidence that Vermont also is the least religious state in all of America. Do you think it's coincidence that there's not this, people don't have this transcendent reality, this thing that they're tapped into that gives them meaning, you know, that gives them a sense of value? It's not here. So they're on the drugs. Life is boring. You take God out of the picture, for most people, if they're intellectually honest, life becomes very boring. And I think that's what's happened. We were meant for greatness. We were meant for something huge, big, bigger than ourselves. And it's not here in Vermont. So what do we do with our trivial lives and our silliness and our preoccupation with all the stuff on TV? Is we run to something to numb us, to give us an adrenaline rush, give us some excitement. And oftentimes for people, that's drugs or alcohol. But before a lot of you sit here like myself and pat yourself on the back because we don't do drugs, just think about all the other ways which we distract ourselves from reality, right? We all do it. Now, maybe it's not drugs for us. A big one in our culture is television, and smartphones, and all of that sort of thing, social media. In many respects, TV is just another drug. It fills up our boredom. Reality is not satisfying enough, so we watch TV, and it distracts us, and it amuses us. But on TV, the problem with television is not, I'm not condemning all of television, I don't think it's an evil device or something like that. We have a couple of really big ones up there, and we like them a lot. So it's not, I'm not, you know, condemning TV. But you really need to be aware of what you're doing when you're watching TV, and what TV is, and how much time you give to it, and all that. Because TV displays everything in the form of entertainment. Doesn't matter what it is. And I will argue that to my grave, that whatever comes across that TV screen is displayed as entertainment. The nuclear bomb in Iran and all that stuff is going on, still entertainment. It's still about keeping you on that channel and that show and having you watch those commercials and all of that. It's an entertainment medium. The problem with that is this. Who cares if it's true? I mean, do you see the dilemma? Who cares if it's right or wrong? Just keep us amused and entertained. That's the problem. So Huxley was right, I think, and Postman's on to something here when he's talking about this guy, Aldous Huxley. We've created one big amusement park here in America, and it's killing us. But why am I saying all that? Okay, Joshua, what's it got to do with, you know, 1 Corinthians chapter 2? That's my job, right? Not to be social critic and up here talking about all this stuff, and don't really like doing that, honestly. It's kind of neat in some ways to sort of look at things, but reality is, I want to get us back to helping us to see and kind of have a taste of what's going on in the Bible, and that's why I share all that, is to say Paul was dealing with something very similar. In 1 Corinthians chapter 2, there was this reality, I think, of amusement, and people wanted to be entertained, and that was kind of the culture of the time, very much like ours. Content and truth were on the back burners, if on the stove at all. They were not in the forefront. Form had taken its place. We were concerned with what things looked like and how amusing they were. And all of this had found its way into the church. How does that happen? Well, let me ask you to think about this for a minute. What happens when you stop thinking, when you stop evaluating? What happens when that takes place? Usually you conform. It's only natural. You conform. We are pack animals, whether you believe that's a result of evolution, whatever you believe that's a result of. I don't believe that, but I believe that that's a natural tendency that we have. We conform to that's what's around us. Whatever's going on, right or wrong, good or bad, we are conforming creatures. And most of us, it happens when we don't think. Mark Knoll, he's an expert in Christian history, he's a historian, he wrote a book called The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind. And what he said in that book was, the scandal of the evangelical mind, the opening quote of the book, is that there isn't much of an evangelical mind. That's the scandal. And the church has this reputation, does it not? At least in most places down south where I'm from. know about up here. I'm still kind of getting used to the culture and stuff up here. But where I'm from down south, if you're in the church, most likely you're a backwoods, uneducated. You know, that's sort of the impression that people have of the church. And there are actually statistics do show that the more educated you get, the less religious you get. There are direct correlations. And some of this literature that I've been reading says that's a big problem. Because that's a modern trend. It hasn't always been like that. In fact, for hundreds of years, the church was the most educated group in the world. I mean, really, some of the most educated people, some of the most educated cultures and societies ever were here in America in the early founding days. And they were deeply religious. Oz Guinness, who's another writer, says this. He says, failing to think Christianly, to use your mind as a Christian, evangelicals have been forced into the role of cultural imitators and adapters rather than originators. So what happens when you don't use your brain, and all of us, when we don't, we conform. And the church has been very guilty of that. You just sort of take on the values of the world around you. And we have surrendered our minds to the culture. Okay, and there's a couple of real dangers that I want to mention for us. And this is, again, headed right towards, I'm going to be getting into what Paul is looking at here. The danger of becoming a religion. So Christians that surrender their mind have two real dangers. You have the danger of becoming a religion. In other words, you and I spend all our time around each other as a church, right? If we're not thinking, then maybe we just kind of take on the values of the other people in the church. So it becomes more about just doing what we do as a church and not really evaluating, is this right, is this wrong, is this the core of the Scripture? We're just doing what the church does. You begin to embrace the status quo inside the doors of the church. You're concerned with what you are doing, maybe more than what God has done. Or another sort of danger is that you're more concerned with the culture, right? Maybe you consume the culture around you if you're not thinking and, you know, begin to conform to the culture, whether it's outside the church or inside the church. You see that distinction I'm trying to make? You can conform to the inside the church culture, or you can conform to the outside the church culture. Those are both real dangers. And for most people, I think we worry about the outside the church culture. That's kind of where the church is usually concerned. But what if both are in play? And I think this is what happened in Corinth. What if both are in play? What if the church has sort of conformed to the culture outside the world, outside in the world, outside the doors of the church, and then said, legitimized that, and said, oh, this is now inside the church. It's been here for a long time. That must be good. That must be right. And so literally the church, the culture outside the church becomes a legitimate form of church culture. Does that make sense, kind of what I'm trying to say there? I know it's a kind of wordy, but that's what was happening in Corinth. Corinth was dealing with a culture outside that basically valued rhetoric. It valued public speaking. It valued sort of entertainment and amusement. And public speakers were like celebrities. They traveled around. They had a big following. They would enter a town, and literally this big entourage would follow them and sort of say, wow, look at the great so-and-so. Look at this person. Listen to them speak. How amazing they talk. Ancient writings confirm all of this. We have all these old documents that even outside the Bible, which talk about this tradition. They were called sophists. And it comes from the Greek word sophia, wisdom. And Paul uses that word three times in our text today to talk about what his message is not. And so there's something really profound here that he's getting at. And that's why I'm going into all this detail about the culture, not trying to, you know, to put all this information on you, but really these details matter. That this is what was going on in the world around them. There was this culture of sort of Hollywood kind of culture with these speakers and entertainment. But you know that their messages were more about amusement than they were about content. They weren't about talking about the issues, the truth of the matter. It was about making people feel good and amusing them, swaying the crowd. So here comes Paul with this gospel, what we call good news, into that context. And what does he have to do? He has to make some distinctions. He has to explain, that's not what I'm doing. I may be public speaking. I may be doing, you know, a similar action, similar thing, But I'm not conforming to what these other people, to their practices and their standards. And that's where our text is coming from today. That's what Paul is dealing with. He's in this culture, and he's got to say, okay, I know this is what you expect, because this is the culture and it's crept into the church. That's what you expect, but I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to parade myself around and present myself as this great figure. I'm concerned with Jesus and with His message and what that's about and what God has said and what God has done. It's a very different kind of thing. So in verses 1, 4, and 5, if you glance at your text there, if you have it open, you see the word wisdom in one way or another. That word, as I said, in the Greek, in the original, for those of you who don't know, the New Testament was written in Greek originally and moved over into English and, you know, hundreds of other languages. And the Old Testament was a mixture of Hebrew and Aramaic, but the New Testament's in the Greek. And the Greek, the word there is a form of Sophia, and that means wisdom. And these sophists, which were the people who set the standards of rhetoric, they were the people who went basically set the bar for what was sort of normal expectation for a wise public figure to abide by. Paul, three times, basically said, I'm not doing that. I did not do this. I did not do that. I'm not going to, you know, basically says verse 1, he says it right here, I'll read it. I did not come with eloquence or human wisdom. That wisdom, that's Sophia. As I proclaim to you the testimony about God. I have a commentary back here where a guy who's an expert on the culture of the time and the original languages, it's a beast. It's a very comprehensive commentary, kind of one of the leading books on the 1 Corinthians. 1,500 pages, the beast. But he says this. He says, he comes up with his own sort of translation to capture what Paul's getting at. And this is his translation. Not mine, his. I did not come with high-sounding rhetoric or a display of cleverness in proclaiming to you the mystery of God. So it kind of captures maybe what Paul is dealing with there. But what is he getting at? Why, when Paul says that I did not come with eloquence or lofty speech, is he saying that preachers, that speakers, okay, don't use big words, don't be smart, don't be intelligent, don't get too deep with people, don't go over their heads. What's he saying? Why is he saying that? Should we seek to persuade people? Should we seek to convince them? Because he says it wasn't with persuasive words. So what's he saying? No, that's not what Paul's saying. Paul's not saying, dumb it down, be trivial, be surfacey, don't go too deep. It's not what Paul is saying. If he is, then he's not taking his own advice, because Paul is a very difficult man to understand and interpret sometimes. And even Peter in the Scriptures said this. In 2 Peter 3, there's a verse where it says, our beloved brother Paul, according to the wisdom given to him, wrote to you in other letters which are hard to understand. So, okay, that's just in the Scriptures. And so, I mean, we believe as Christians, obviously Scripture doesn't contradict itself. That's a presupposition that we hold. That's something we believe. So is the Scripture contradicting itself? Or is Paul saying something else here? Is Paul saying, no, it's not, I'm not saying, you know, dumb it down and be surfacey and don't go too deep with people. Well, I think what Paul is attacking here, and this is where kind of a lot of the experts, the scholars I was reading, go with it, is they say Paul is attacking the presentation, not the substance. He's not attacking the message, the content. He's attacking the presentation. He's attacking this thing in the broader culture, this wisdom sort of tradition, this rhetoric, these sophists who were going around, you know, using words as tools to play with people's emotions and reeling them in. Maybe a little bit like what our media and our politicians do today. It's not about truth. It's not about telling us what's really going on. It's about that hook and getting us to buy into whatever it is that they're wanting us to believe. That is what was going on in the culture. And Paul says, I didn't do that. I just shared the truth with you. That's what Paul says. Paul wasn't about artificial communication, trying to get applause from men like these other speakers. He was about the truth. Okay, now this is the last kind of big piece of the puzzle I want to put together for us. Is this thing that Paul says, demonstration of the Holy Spirit. What does that mean? He's talking about In verse 3 through 5, he says this right here. He says, I came to you in weakness with great fear and trembling. My message and my preaching were not with wise and persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power, so that your faith might not rest on human wisdom, but on God's power. So do you hear that comparison that Paul's making there? He's got a demonstration of the Spirit, persuasive words of wisdom, and then human wisdom and God's power, all these ideas out there. Well, he's comparing wise and persuasive words and this idea of the demonstration of the Spirit's power. He's saying those aren't the same thing. So he's kind of making a comparison here in verse 4 and verse 5. Well, what does he mean by demonstration of the Spirit's power? On the surface, it might seem that Paul's talking about miracles or something, right? He's calling fire down from heaven while he's speaking, saying, look at this, you know, I'm showing you how true all of this is because I can call down fire or do magic or miracles or something. That's kind of on the surface maybe where our mind goes, some kind of supernatural display, but that would not be right. Well, oftentimes the key, if you're in a text like this and you're wrestling to try and find out what does it mean, what is going on here, the best thing to do is just look at the context. Look at what's going on in context. And there's two clues in the context that Paul gives us about what demonstration of Spirit means. And the first one is this. He's talking about the message all throughout, right? That's what we've been talking about the last 2 weeks, the message of the cross. Remember, I've been going into that over and over and over. He shared this message with the Corinthians. Nowhere does he mention miracles. And in fact, he says, we don't do signs, which is what Jews expect. And we don't do wisdom, which is what Greeks expect. But we preach Christ. So he's talking about the message. Second clue is this. We talked about foolishness last week, right? We talked about, remember how the message of the cross is foolish? And it's foolish because, not because it's irrational, like, you know, like a married bachelor or like 2 + 2 = 3 or something like that. That's not foolish, the kind of foolishness. It's foolishness because it's other, it's different. We expect greatness and power and glory, and he comes as a lamb. He comes and lays down his life in weakness. And so it's foolish because it's different, and it's not what we expect. That's what Paul's talking about. So keep these two clues in mind. And those two clues help us understand what Paul is saying about a demonstration of the Spirit's power here. He's saying this, that the Christian message of the gospel is, in a way, its own proof. The Greek that's rendered here in verse 4, the word demonstrate or demonstration there, actually scholars, as they've studied the Greek, there's other, you know, Greek literature in ancient times. In a lot of the extra-biblical literature, this word demonstrate is used in the context of proof. So it's kind of getting at the idea of proving something. And it stands in contrast to the idea of persuasion. So you see, the goal of rhetoric and the goal of the sophists at that time that were going around wasn't evidence. It was persuasion. I'm going to persuade you aside from the evidence. I have no evidence. I'm going to try and persuade you. And the good speakers could do that. They could persuade you of the most ridiculous things. And that's what they were doing. Paul says, I don't do that. I am proving to you. I am speaking sound truth. I'm not persuading you. I'm not trying to hook you or deceive you. So Paul is more concerned with truth and with honoring what is right. He wants to let the truth speak for itself. Okay, so this kind of, and then there's this word power, right? That helps us understand the word power in verse 4 too. In the Jewish mind, think about this, and I'm wrapping it up here. In the Jewish mind, think of the Old Testament. Think of all the stories in the Old Testament where, you know, God sort of does something unexpected, something, you know, against, you know, what we would think. Like King David, perfect example. He, normally in the Old Testament, kings would be the oldest son. They would be the brawniest, the biggest, you know, the most handsome or whatever, most warrior-like son. David was a runt. David was the youngest. God chose him to bring his kingdom, right? Moses. Moses couldn't speak. He said, Lord, why are you sending me to deliver the people out of bondage? He said, because I've called you to do it. Moses said, I can't talk. I struggle with my words. That doesn't matter. That will serve my purpose even more. Jeremiah said, I'm too young, Lord. Don't call me into the ministry. Don't call me into this. That's the way I felt. Lord, I can't do this. Don't do it. God said, no, you're going. And Gideon as well, and the judges, and that whole story about Gideon, how he was a coward, and he didn't want to go fight the, you know, these enemies that were coming in and taking over Israel. And God whittled their numbers down. He said, you have a few thousand people in your army, take it down to 300 and then go in. God uses weak things to show and to display His power. So do you see how He's saying demonstration of the Spirit and power? There's more to that word than what Paul, because Paul was a Hebrew, Paul was a Jew. He had all this in his mind as he's speaking to these people. So maybe power, there's more to this statement than we think. It's not about this big display of power. It's getting at something else. And in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, Paul says this, my grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness. Paul believed that by communicating the content of the message faithfully, he proves the power of the message for those who come to faith, because it proves that the message is why they came to faith. It proves that God is behind this message, not manipulation, force, or deceit. You share the raw truth with someone and they embrace it. There's power in that, and not because I deceived you or manipulated you or pulled your heartstrings or something like that to get you to come. Paul says, I didn't do that like these people. And what is more, the power of that truth is even more plain because the message is a weak message. Is it not? What is the cross? I mean, the cross, it's about weakness. And Paul himself said, I came in weakness and fear and trembling. Maybe he was dealing with some bodily issue. Maybe he was sick. But more likely, I don't think that's what he was referring to. More likely, he's referring to the fact that I'm not relying on all these tricks and these routines and this veneer of, you know, all the pomp and display. I don't have all these people here bringing me into town and talking about how great I am so that you'll listen to me. He says, no, I came in weakness. And I shared about this God who came down and was weak and He died for us. He used His weak, unadulterated methods to bring Christ to these people. So Paul says that is, in a way, a proof of its power, of the message's power. The message is spreading. The Corinthians embraced it. He's not speaking to skeptics. He's speaking, these people know Jesus. They love Jesus. And yeah, they had lost their way a little bit. But the power of the message was seen in the fact that I came in weakness and didn't even embrace all that mess. And I preached Christ and you came. And you embraced it. And there's power in that. So that's a kind of proof, is it not? A weak message delivered by a weak man, yet power comes out of it. So he's saying that he was faithful in his task, not by following the designs and customs of the culture, but by sharing this message and watching it produce fruit. That was a demonstration of the Spirit's power. That this weak story and this weak message and this weak method, I'm not over here with my sword stabbing you in the neck saying, believe this. No, I'm just talking to you about it. He said, there's power in that. We're not manipulating and forcing people like so many others. Okay, well, what does this mean for us? To tie it up here right at the last minute or so with some application. Okay, Josh, you said all this great stuff. What does it mean? Well, you remember in the beginning I said this is really a message about evangelism, didn't I? I said that it's about sharing your faith and talking to people about Christ, which I hope if you love Jesus, that's something that you do on occasion, that it comes out, and it should, like anything else that you love. Well, I think what God has for us in the text today is to tell us that we shouldn't be wrapped up in appearances, right? Shouldn't be wrapped up in what it looks like. And what we think we look like, how we come across, or whatever. I mean, like up here, I could worry about that really easily. I'm trying to be myself. And I hope that comes across all right. Sometimes I doubt that it does, especially once I sit down and listen to this. I'm like, wow, that was... I hear my accent, and I hear all that, and it's a little uncomfortable. But it is who I am. I have to be who I am, right? So the church is supposed to be about truth. And I think... So often, you know, one of the worst experiences that many of us have with the church is that it ceases to be about the truth and becomes consumed with appearances, with how we come across, with politics or whatever. I know that bothers a tremendous number of people in this country. Well, there's two sides on this. So I'm going to talk about it really quick from both angles. There's, on the one hand, there's those of us in the room who think like this. What if I'm seen spending time with those people? What if someone sees me over there hanging out with them? What if I'm caught in town at the bar or in the club or at a party with some students? What if I'm caught playing video games? What if I'm caught spending time with the gossips or with the drug addicts? That wouldn't look good, would it? There's people in this room that think like that. But on the other side of the equation, there's those in the room who think like this. What if I'm caught hanging out with those bigots and those religious snobs? What if I'm caught hanging out with those people who think they're better than everyone else? Or those who think that I'm not good enough for God? Or those people who judge others? Both views not only miss the point, but are just flat out wrong in a number of ways, which I don't have time to go all into. But the bottom line is this, Jesus wasn't concerned with that stuff. Jesus just did what he felt like God asked him to do. Paul wasn't either. The main thing for these men was just being faithful. God has given me a message, I want to share it, whatever that looks like, wherever God sends me. And the second piece I want to quickly share with you is providing proof. Paul wasn't afraid to talk about proving things. Paul wasn't afraid. There's this impression, I think, out there in the Christian world that we just got to jump off the end of the cliff and hopefully God will catch us, and you know, we got to believe this ridiculous message, and there's no proof and there's no evidence for it whatsoever. We go against science and we go against what everyone else knows to be true. No, it's ridiculous. That's not at all. We believe, if what we believe is true, we shouldn't have any fear of that. Like, Christ came down as a historical figure. That's one of the most well-documented facts that we know about the ancient world. There's this man named Jesus, and he died on the cross. And there's all this other evidence from manuscripts that we have to all sorts of even just rationally understanding what it says in the Bible. It makes good sense. We have a lot of reasons to stand firm in the face of a culture of doubt and skepticism. So study up on this stuff and give people a reason to believe. Do some homework, you'll be blown away. God has invaded history, and we demonstrate the power of God more clearly when we give people strong reasons to believe our simple faith. There's something of power in that. One of those is not getting them into the faith by using manipulation. So we're not manipulating people, which is very easy. Why ain't you in church? Why ain't you? I ain't seen you at church lately. What's your problem? That's just a guilt trip. That doesn't help people. You know, and I'm, there may be a time and place for that. You know, I can maybe imagine some scenarios where you might want to say that to someone, but there's better reasons to get folks to love Jesus or to encourage them to love Christ. So anyway, that was a mouthful. The last thing I might say to you is to think, to not be worried about, you know, using these persuasive words. We have this idea that we need to be real simple and real, you know, basic in what we say, and there's some truth in that. But the greatest commandment is love God with all your mind, heart, soul, and strength, right? The mind is a part of that.